the two brothers, how one should persuade St. Planius to philosophize and to practice virtue, how one should drive him forward. What is the ordinary English translation for protrepine? Exhort, exhort. Yeah, it's a bit weak, but all right. Exhort, and Socrates only exhorts to wisdom, let us say. And the process shows the impossibility of wisdom. And the interplay of these two things, this is the action of this dialogue. And it is, of course, here, but the question is, why? Now, well, I think we leave it open for the time being until we see how they go about the protreptic. Perhaps we can use now, this as a technical term, the art of exhorting someone towards something. That is called, this is a protreptic art. Well, it is a kind of, on the lowest level, advertising. Advertising is distinguished from, say, if a school advertises either itself or one of its symposia or this kind of thing, that is protrepine, inducing people to come to do that. And then the actual teaching is something different. It is something different. So in other words, what Socrates wants is something entirely preparatory. Here is teaching virtue. Yeah, now I see my point. Teaching virtue is, of course, the only interesting thing. But still, there is a previous question. Is virtue teachable? And this is preparatory. Before we can teach virtue, we must be sure virtue can be taught. And now we see something in a way still more preparatory. How to persuade a man to become concerned with virtue, this could conceivably be done even if virtue is not teachable. Yes, that's the point. Because let us assume virtue is acquired by some other means, and not by teaching proper. Say by sheer training, mere training without teaching, like training in some sport. The most preparatory of things which could be done is to persuade people to become concerned with virtue. And that is what Socrates expects of the two brothers. Now, in order to induce the two brothers, in order to exhort the two brothers to do their exhortation, Socrates must explain to them the situation, what he does in the immediate sequel.
For the truth about this boy is that both I myself and all these happen to desire that he should become as good as possible.
All these, you see, here Socrates shows points, and that can of course not be rendered in the text. We have to think a bit about it. These are naturally the lovers and not the pupils of the sophists. Whereas in other cases when he says all these, the accompanying gesture embraces also the pupils and not merely the lovers. You know, we have to find out this for ourselves. Yes?
This is the son of Axiochus and the grandson of the elder famous Alcibiades. And cousin.
Famous is an addition of the translator. But it is, of course, it's not even necessary to say. It's even an insult to say. Because, of course, Alcibiades is famous. Yes?
And cousin of the present Alcibiades. His name is Clinias. He is young, and we are afraid for him, as is fitting for young men, lest someone may anticipate us and turn his mind in some other direction and ruin him.
And corrupt him. Corrupt him, I wouldn't say that. So in other words, Socrates takes refuge to the two sophists to prevent the corruption of young Clinias. That is a very strange situation. Yes.
You have come, then, at the best time. If you do not mind, please make trial of the lad and talk with him before us. When I had spoken, almost in these very words, Euthydemus answered bravely and boldly, "Oh, we don't mind, Socrates, if the young man is only willing to answer." "Why, he is quite used to that," I said. "These people here are always coming and talking with him and asking all sorts of questions, so he is not at all shy in answering."
Yeah. So, now the stage is really fully set for this first exhibition, and from what we have been promised, it is an exhibition of the protracted art of the two brothers. And whether we have no right to assume that this will be aristic. But we must not forget the aristic, we know that only from Socrates' report to Crito, Miss Schroeder, never forget that. That's the next day. We are not yet so far. Yes?
"What followed, Crito, how could I describe properly? It is not a small business to recall and repeat such irresistible wisdom. So I must begin my description, as the poets do, by invoking the Muses and memory herself. Well, Euthydemus, I think, began something like this."
Yeah, now, for 1 second, on this point, Socrates, well, you can, of course, say that is mockery, but we have also to take the mockery seriously. Plato took it seriously enough by writing it down. He calls on memory, that goes without saying, but also on the Muses. And he, in this case, poetic Muses in the first place. So this whole description is poetic. And he shows it immediately by saying, Euthydemus, I believe, began there. So in no verbatim report. And how much Socrates invented on the occasion for the benefit of Crito is impossible to say. But this much is quite clear. There are other examples. Yeah, by the way, a little bit before in B7, this is what I had mentioned, more or less, also not literal, not verbatim. Yes. Now we come to the crucial point.
"Now, Clinias, which of mankind are the learners, the wise or the ignorant?" This was a large question, so the boy blushed and looked at me in doubt. Seeing that he was troubled, I said, "Clinias, be brave and answer like a man, whichever it seems to you, for perhaps it will do you a great good." Just then, Dionysodorus leaned over me and whispered in my ear, smiling all over his face, "Now, Socrates, I prophesy to you that whichever the lad answers, he will be refuted."
Now, I would translate the Greek words the wise and the unwise in order to make it intelligible. Yes?
"While he spoke, Clinias happened to make...
That is important. Why Dionysodorus makes this prophecy to Socrates? Socrates is prevented from warning Clinias again. Clinias gives an answer, and he's caught. Now, go on.
"While he spoke, Clinias happened to make his answer, so I couldn't warn the boy to take care."
Yeah.
"And he answered that the wise were the learners. And Euthydemus said, 'There are people you call teachers, aren't there?' He agreed. 'The teachers are teachers of the learners, just as the music master and the grammar master were teachers of you and the other boys, and you were learners.' He agreed. 'Of course, at the time when you were learning, you did not yet know the things you were learning.' 'No,' he said. 'Then you were wise when you did not know these things?' 'Certainly not,' he said. 'If not wise, then unwise?' 'Yes. So you boys, while learning what you did not know, were unwise and were learning.' The boy nodded. 'So the unwise learn, Clinias, not the wise, as you suppose.'"
Yeah. Now, here are many things to observe. If it's such a little thing, for example, when you look at the answers of poor Clinias, he agreed. He said yes. He said no. And then he is explicitly quoted. Yeah. And he says, no. And then he says, certainly. And then he only nodded. He is reduced to silence. And that is brought out by, you see how careful Plato is even in these little things. First he has no direct speech. Then he turns to direct speech of the boy. Yes, no, certainly. And the direct speech, i.e. speech proper, in order to bring out then the sudden silencing, non-speech. Yeah, but if you look at such a passage by itself, without looking what happened before and what after, of what does it remind you? Of things which you have read before?
Like anything Socrates.
Exactly. It reads like a Socratic refutation, or to use a Greek term, a Socratic elenchios. Exactly. You couldn't, without great difficulties, in the first book of the Republic, then also when Thrasymachus is reduced to a point where he only nods, yes, good. But we have to read also the sequel, so that we can consider the argument as a whole. After he had said this.
Just like a chorus, when the leader signals, they all cheered and laughed. I mean the followers with Dionysodorus and Euthydemus. Then
That was exactly the beautiful sight. How they licks this boy. Yes.
Then before the boy could take one good breath, Dionysodorus took over and said, what happened, Clinias, when the grammar man dictated to you? Which of the boys learned the things dictated, the wise or the unwise? The wise, said Clinias. Then the wise learned, and not the unwise, and you answered wrong just now to Euthydemus. Then indeed the two men's lovers laughed loud and long, applauding
now their wisdom. Now they become the lovers, you see. Because the admiration and love are two different things, as you probably know. But here there is still only one step, more or less long, from admiration to love, which is here taken. After the second terrific success, the admiration has become love. Yes?
Laughed loud and long, applauding their wisdom. But all the rest of us were dumbstruck and had nothing to say.
Yeah. Let me stop here. Yes?
I find it really curious that Clinias' lovers were, because of his beauty, the beauty of his body and whatnot, and here they were, because the brothers merely had companions, but now that they've defeated this boy, they now have lovers, and it's because of this victory in speech. I mean, they're attracted at least to something other than the bodies, something to do with speech.
Yes. Yeah, but formerly there was admiration, and the question is, good. Now, first of all, what is the fallacy which enables them to refute both assertions? The wise learn and the unwise learn. In which sense do the wise learn, in which sense do the unwise learn? We have to make this clear. Yes?
Well, I mean, it's the unwise, and that they're learning something they don't know, so they're unwise with respect to that.
So it applies it by another expression to make it quite clear. Unwise meaning first in that case?
Not knowing anything about it.
Let us say the ignorant. Yes, in the other case?
In the other case, they're wise in that they know some things which are necessary to know something more.
This is not the point. I mean, one must be ignorant in order to learn. Otherwise, one doesn't learn, but only repeats what one knows already. So the ignorant and only the ignorant learn. Which unwise do not learn?
Stupid.
Exactly. So the whole thing turns around this ambiguity of the Greek word for unwise, amatais, which can mean ignoramuses and which can mean stupid. That is simple. But another point is of greater importance. Although it's not unimportant to make clear to one what is going on in such a fallacy. Let us for a moment take this game seriously. The wise cannot learn. The unwise cannot learn. And the whole human race consists of wise and unwise. What does it follow? We can do it both ways. The wise learn and the unwise learn. But it is more interesting to start from the other. The wise do not learn, and the unwise do not learn. Nobody can learn. Wisdom is impossible. If we take the other side, the wise learn and the unwise learn. Yeah? Fun?
Everyone
is wise. All men are wise.
Wisdom. In your first formulation, strictly speaking, it follows that learning is impossible. You said the wise, because you said the wise and the unwise. The wise cannot learn because they know. The unwise cannot learn because they know.
Yeah, no, if we consider the fallacy, the whole difficulty doesn't arise. But if we blind ourselves, as it were, to the fallacy, because Plato works on various levels, and then I would say we arrive at this view. Wisdom is impossible, is the one conclusion. And the other conclusion is wisdom is not only possible, but most easy to obtain. Everyone has it. So, now, good. This is a clear contradiction. Pardon?
Well, maybe not. Because if everybody can learn wisdom, then wisdom itself is a meaningless concept. And therefore...
Sure. You are quite right. But still, we are not... You are too subtle now. We are now in the very beginning of the argument. So, but if we leave it at this massive and simple contradiction, wisdom is impossible, wisdom is easily obtainable. What would follow from this, from this contradiction?
Well, it would seem that wisdom is not anything that we could bother talking about. It's
no. I think I would draw the conclusion, is wisdom possible? It's a question.
I draw the conclusion that if, especially on the basis of the latter, wise and unwise both learn and become wise. I mean, that means the unwise are in fact wise already. You know, you just throw up your hands.
Yeah, but sure, no, this is a fallacy, and the fallacy is based on the lacking distinction of the twofold meaning of the term for unwise. It is important to notice this because Socrates will later on give a diagnosis of what happened. And this diagnosis, it doesn't quite jibe with what actually happens. These things happen sometimes in Platonic dialogues, and therefore we must watch that very carefully. I believe I would draw this conclusion. Is wisdom possible? And I believe this is the theme of this dialogue.
Okay, yeah. Another level, right?
Yeah. But there are a variety of levels.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Yes. Now, can you read this again, the last sentence, Mr. Pangle, which you read?
Then indeed...
We others...
All the rest of us were dumbstruck and had nothing to say.
Yeah, we were dumbstruck, yes. Yes?
Euthydemus noticed that we were dumbstruck and wanted us to admire him more.
Even more?
Even more.
Yeah. So in other words, they are dumbstruck and they admire Euthydemus. And that is true not only of the others, but also of Socrates. This we must keep in mind, because shortly thereafter, say about 2 pages later, Socrates will begin to speak and tell his opinion about what has been going on. And there is not the slightest sign of Socrates being dumbstruck and Socrates is admiring the two brothers. And we must then see in retrospect what this passage here means. Yes?
So he would not let the boy alone, but he went on asking, doubling and twisting around the same question like the clever dancers. He said, do the learners learn what they know or what they don't know. And Dean Isidorus whispered softly to me again, here's another Socrates, just like the first.
Yes.
Oh, Zeus, I said. Really, that first one of yours seemed to us a fine question.
Yeah.
All our questions are like that, Socrates. No escape.
Pangle, you're made for the part.
Now, I said, I can see why you have such a reputation among your pupils. Meanwhile, Clinias answered Euthydemus that the learners learned what they did not know, and he went on in the same way, as before. Very well. Do you not know your letters? Yes, he said. All of them, eh? He agreed. And when someone dictates anything, does he not dictate letters? He agreed. Then he dictates a bit of what you know, if you know all. He agreed to this too. Very well, he said. You do learn what someone dictates, and the one who does not know letters learns them. No, he said, I learn them. Then you learn what you know, since you know all the letters. He agreed. Then you did not answer right, he said. The word had scarcely come out of Euthydemus' mouth when Dionysodorus caught it like a ball and aimed it again at the boy, saying, Euthydemus is cheating you, Clinias. Just tell me, is not learning getting knowledge of whatever one learns? Clinias agreed. But to know, he went on, is surely to have knowledge of something already. He said, yes. Then not to know is not yet to have knowledge. He agreed with this. Well, are those who get anything those who have it already, or those who have not? Those who have not. Have you not agreed that those who do not know belong also to this class, those who have not? He nodded. And the learners are of the class who get, not those who have? He said yes. Then those who do not know learn, Clinias, not those who do.
Yes, and this is the first pair of rounds. And then they want to start the third, and then Socrates intervenes and says, and makes a long speech to Clinias, in which he explains to him what has happened, and says all doesn't have to be taken seriously, and gives reasons. But this we will consider next time. We should start it with a fresh mind. Now, perhaps we reconsider the whole thing as we have read it or reread it today. There must be many points which either we overlooked or which come to sight in retrospect after we've gone on. Yes.
Right at the beginning.
You mean at the beginning of the dialogue?
Yes, 271A. Beginning 271B. When Crito says, Socrates, the one I mean was sitting third from you on your right. Is that the correct translation?
Yes, that has to do with the Greek way of counting.
In other words, Socrates becomes one.
Here is Mr. Fairbanks is the third right from me.
I understand.
Counting me.
Yes, Socrates is 1, 2, 3.
Yeah.
Mr. Strauss, you didn't mention this today, but in your first introduction, you, in contrasting the Euthydemus with the Crito and talking about their relationship, you mentioned that on the surface of things, on the first surface of the dialogue, one could say that the Euthydemus is the most playful or the most frivolous of the dialogue,
yeah,
and the Crito is the most solemn of the dialogue.
Yeah.
But in the Euthydemus, there is a movement from playfulness to seriousness, in a
yes
sense.
Yes and no.
Well, I mean, in the beginning, Socrates calls what he's doing play, and later he stops calling it play. Is there a similar movement in the Crito?
No. In the Crito, there is no... Well,
I mean, not on the surface of things, but...
Yeah, we are speaking only on the surface. And of the surface, there is Secretum is serious from beginning to end. But here, I would say this is mock serious from the beginning to the end. And the only question regarding this, and that's indeed a question of some importance, is what the first addressee of this dialogue, whether he saw the mock seriousness or not. You know, we, after all, are only permitted to listen in. We are not directly addressed by Socrates. And I would say, no, this, the, well, the whole dialogue ends with Socrates is enthusiastic, apparently, about the whole thing, but Crito is very skeptical, and it is not quite clear whether he had a conversation with a third person or whether he creates this, thank you, I got it, whether this third person is a creature of Crito's mind. That is not quite clear. At any rate, this third person was very critical of philosophy. And of course, philosophy that refers within the context of the dialogue to what has been going on there. Yeah, I mean, this to the doings of the two others. And Socrates answers with a counterattack and says, there are people who say the best men are those who are neither philosophers nor politicians, no political men, but some third thing. And the commentators are, of course, mostly concerned at whom does Plato dig? And of course, probably Socrates, which is wholly uninteresting. His interesting thing is what does it mean in the context of the dialogue? But at any rate, Socrates seems to defend what is going on in this dialogue as philosophy.
I think that there's that in a way is true. That is to say, the claims of Nicodemus and Dionysodorus are, as we look at them on the surface, they seem to be absurd. And yet, one could imagine somebody, say, a detached critic, looking at Socrates and perhaps...
Yeah, well, that is, they are, in a way, caricatures of Socrates, of course.
Yeah. But I was just thinking of the specific point. Though somebody who can refute everything, say, if he was a serious person, and that's why the question seems to me, the question is one of what makes a person serious. If as a result of this he knew that he knew nothing, then that could be...
Yeah. Now, what happens here in this dialogue is this. The brothers refute everyone. And Socrates is only exhibiting his, the protreptic art, the art of exhorting people to philosophy, to wisdom, to virtue. And then when the question comes up, eventually to the royal or kingly art, as the art of arts. And then it proves impossible to define this art. So, like, that eludes one. Socrates exhorts to something which he cannot catch, which he cannot lay his hands on. So, if the brother's tacit premise is wisdom is impossible, Socrates seems to be explicitly to teach wisdom is impossible. This is what is happening in the dialogue. But more specifically, limiting himself to happening is this, that here Socrates at the beginning, as you will see from the next few lines when you go on, Socrates is in no way here impressed, although he claims to have been dumbfounded and to be filled with admiration. But then gradually he becomes refuted He really is refuted. And now this is, of course, very funny, because the aristic art is an art with certain rules of the game. And one of the rules of the game is you must not bring in something said on another occasion. For example, if someone, say someone makes a certain assertion, and then someone says, but yesterday you said the opposite, strictly forbidden. So what is said at the beginning, they can refute that which is said at any given time is quite literally. That is what is said at this time now. And any reference to things said earlier or on another occasion is forbidden. And other rules, and in this way, they've been, in an incredibly silly way, they defeat Socrates. And Ctesippus especially is quite overwhelmed and says these men are unbeatable. That is his last word about them. Yeah, and we must try to see what this all means. Surely there is something, there are caricatures of Socrates in a way. Yeah. Yes.
I have two questions. First, you've been comparing this dialogue with a number of other works, and I notice that one thing which hasn't come up is the dramatic setting of the dialogue insofar as except, I mean, this is in a gymnasium, so say women, I assume, would not be there.
No.
But other than that, it's fairly public. And so the Crito is, and the Pythagoras and all these other ones take place in very private circumstances. And I wonder if that doesn't, say, color the whole dramatic action of this dialogue. I mean, as far as I know, I think this and the Apology are the
only
two.
Oh, no. The Charmides.
Yeah.
And the Laches. And the Lucis. Oh, no.
No, I'm sorry.
No, that is important, but it is not a peculiarity of this dialogue.
No.
Whereas the being made possible by the daimonion is a peculiarity of this dialogue. As is the fact that it is, apart from the Crito, the only dialogue in which Crito is a chief character. I mean, at least in the... Oh, I did not bring this out precisely enough. The unique feature in the structure of this dialogue is this. This is a performed dialogue, a dramatic dialogue between Socrates and Crito. And the performed dialogue surrounds and even interrupts a narrated dialogue, narrated by Socrates, between Socrates and other people. There is no other Platonic dialogue of this kind, and the only dialogue which has some similarity with that structure is Crito, where the performed dialogue between Socrates and Crito surrounds the dialogue, the fictitious dialogue, between Socrates and the Lord. It's the nearest parallel to the Euripides. It's another reason why these two dialogues came together. Yes.
The second thing I wanted to know, last week in speaking of the same thing, you brought up the subject of the surface, and in this class too, said the surface. By the surface, do you mean what could be explained to any intelligent 9-year-old, or do you mean what could be explained, or what A.E. Taylor sees? So?
A.E. Taylor, I think, has always, was also, I hope I do not hurt any ethnic feelings of anybody, a very obstinate old Scotchman. You know? With a certain peculiar perverseness. So I would not take him as a... But I would, nor would I say him, say a 12-year-old.
Sociology of error? Are you giving us a sociology?
No, I don't. I don't know what sociology is.
But you do. Do you know what sociology of error is?
No, I have heard sociology of knowledge. Someone spoke about of that.
Well, Mr. Diamond frequently speaks of sociology of error.
Yeah, that is
as a replacement for sociology.
Yeah,
of knowledge.
Yeah. But in other words, that means explanation of ideologies and this kind of thing.
Maybe he doesn't even mean anything that high.
Oh, I see. Yes, then it would probably be psychology. Because his psychology is still lower than sociology. Yes.
I was just going to pose it as a problem that if the whole dialogue takes place because of Socrates' demonic, the central question that his wisdom discoverable, teachable, whatnot, doesn't that make it a rather something almost dependent on divine intervention and almost refuted before you begin?
Yes and no. But perhaps the daimonion is the most massive proof that wisdom is possible. I mean, the most mass, not in the sense of a so-called scientific proof, but what's made Socrates certain that truth is true, that there is a possibility of wisdom, was his daimonion.
It makes it a rather chancy undertaking for others who would follow.
Yeah, that, oh, that well, you, what then we would have to find out first what the daimonion is.
And I noticed later on in the same thing, he said wisdom can reduce the factor, I guess you call it chance, wisdom can overcome
that. Yeah, yeah, but we come to that now. That is in Socrates' protracted speech to Cleinias. Yeah. They are following a rule which I had to impose on myself for some time now. I think we should now stop. In former years, as Mr. Jaffa remembers, there was no end to such things.